Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
You know, I thought about dogs last night. I got to tell you this. I'm not going to go in my dog is great, but my dog is great. This 10-pound poodle, Teddy. I was mad at him for 2 days. I gave him the cold shoulder. He was hurt by it because he peed all over the house from 24. I think it scared him with the atomic bomb and the screaming and the shooting and the yelling. What I had to clean up for 2 days around the house, little hidden areas there. But I forgave him. Now we're friends again. Now every morning I get up, it's the same thing. He sits on this pink chair. I have a recliner that I bought. I don't know how they let this store into Marin County. All the libs were like mad at it. Lazy Boy. When Lazy Boy opened in Marin County, all the phony snobs, ooh, we can't have that in our county. That's not classy. I went and I bought a beautiful recliner that is so ugly, it's unbelievable. It's like ugly chair. Every house must have an ugly chair. That's the only chair you actually wind up sitting in. Beautiful chairs nobody will sit in. If they do, you have to worry that you're going to stain it, you know, with something. But the ugly chair you could sit in, you can eat in it, you can drink in it, coffee could spill on it, doesn't matter. This chair is so comfortable that Teddy took it over. It's his chair. So every morning it's a pink recliner from Lazy Boy. He jumps on the chair and he puts his back up against it and he gives me his two paws out, I swear to God. And he does it. I taught him how to do high five. Give me five. And we do like a, we play. Like I do the hands back and forth, give me five, give me four, give me three. He loves this game. He could have been a circus dog. My dog could have been anything. I wonder how he is. He had a little growth underneath his private part that was worrying me a little bit. He went to the vet today. I don't even know how it came out. You know, maybe we should get the vet on the show, see how Teddy's private parts are, because I want to breed him this year. I don't want him to disappear. How? You know, once in a few hundred thousand years, a perfect animal comes along. How could his genes be lost? He's like Western civilization himself, my dog. We got to breed this dog. I got to have five or six puppies and keep two of them. I'm not going to sell them. You think I'm going to sell them and have a liberal buy them? Oh, yeah, I want. And they're going to send me pictures of them being mauled in a pit bull arena to torture me? No. I would never sell puppies. No, I couldn't do it, you know, because I don't know how they'll be used. I'll keep a couple of them. So I'm becoming like dog, more and more doggy. I mean, I love the dogs. I just love them so much. Because you can trust them. I thought about it last night, his eyes. Now that he like, you know, like he knows I like him again after the peeing thing where I gave him the cold shoulder. Dogs' eyes are very interesting. If you don't abuse your dog, you only get a couple of emotions out of him, but none of them are hate. Did you realize what I just said to you? Most dogs don't know how to hate. Yeah, you could train a dog to hate. I'm not talking about that. In general, in a normal house, a dog has a set of emotions that you could see in their eyes. Admiration, love, happiness. Maybe it's sometimes a little hurt when you leave them and you're going to go out and be a human without them. They don't understand it because they think that they're you. Why can't you take me to that wedding tonight, Dad? What is wrong with you? I'm as good as you. I know, son, but not everybody sees the world the way you do. Not everybody wants short, furry creatures running around at weddings or in restaurants. You'll have to just stay home. So you get those, but you never get hate. Does dog ever look at you with hatred? No. Which is why we love them. You understand that? Well, you should have a dog. And by the way, don't trust people who don't have dogs. The tiny lump under his testicles turns out to be benign. There's nothing there. So, I mean, it was pretty worrisome because there's a little tiny lump there. And like any living creature, you know, or the way of all flesh, you worry. You know, maybe the little guy has cancer or something. But it turns out he's probably bitten by some bug and it scabbed over and it disappeared. But he sure enjoyed licking himself down there all the months that he thought of. He had a justification. Look, who can blame him, you know? I think the reason we're not dogs, or one of the reasons that they are dogs, is they can do that, however you look at it. I mean, normal men can't do that. That's why we're not dogs. If we were, see, if we were double jointed like that, we probably would be dogs. So God made it so you can't do that. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you have an animal, it's amazing to watch how they behave. Even a little thing like a bite in their private parts, what they do with I'm just elated. I'm not felinophobic. Don't get me wrong. I'm not exactly a felinophile. But I prefer dogs because dogs to me are covert and cats dogs are overt and cats are covert. Cats remind me of people in Pacific Heights or in the San Francisco government. Everything they do is hidden and secretive. It's like Choirgate. They're trying to sweep it into the cat litter box, but I kind of doubt that that's where it's going to end up. You know, they're like cats in this city, like cats that are really dirty, that gussy themselves up with Da Vinci dresses. But behind it, you know that there's dirty underwear. That's what the whole city reminds me of. The miners came in 49 and 51, the whores. You ever hear that? Mark Twain wrote it. I'm sure many of you love it. I didn't write it. Mark Twain did before the Fairness Doctrine. That's not a dirty word. In 49, the miners came, in 51, the whores. And then he says, and then something evolved from it. It's called Pacific Heights. That's how they run San Francisco. But they put on dresses from back east, you know, we have one of the best Opry's west of the Hudson and the Mississippi River. We put on quite a symphony out here. Oh, it's so out of town that I love it. There's no bigger small town than San Francisco. I wouldn't mind if they were patriotic or Americana. But my God, how could they be so anti-American? It's hard to believe. Everything that's family-oriented, they despise. They spit on the flag, the Boy Scouts. But thank God Teddy's okay, that's all. I can't wait to see the little guy after the show. Go home, talk to him. Say, Teddy, I am so glad you went to the doctor and you don't have a tumor under your private parts, but stop licking them already. There's no excuse anymore. You can't say, Dad, it itches, or Dad, there's a problem. You're just being a dirtbag if you keep doing it, Ted. I can't do that because I'll give them a complex. I think you can give dogs a complex. They are very sensitive to criticism. Oh, my God. They're like liberals. Liberals are very good at pretending they don't care what you say to them, but boy, do they care. Whoa, they're thin-skinned.
Savage.
U.S. couple seeks separate bedrooms. Ah, look at this story. A survey by the National Association of Home Builders has predicted by 2015, 60% of custom-built homes will have two master bedroom suites. This is an amazing story. The quest for better rest is behind the trend, as experts say the lack of decent sleep can cause marital tension. The option of having separate rooms has often improved marriages, they say. And they're not calling it separate bedrooms because people are embarrassed to admit it. They call it a flex suite, to avoid any embarrassment. And it says the trend is not restricted to the upper end of the market. They say that with the practical necessity, snoring, nighttime visits to the bathroom, children, shift working, couples are often deprived a good night's sleep, so they're having two separate master suites. Let me tell you a little secret about that. It's only the poor who sleep in the same bed for their whole life, generally, and not everybody, don't get me wrong. It's a mark of poverty to have to share a bed with someone your whole life. The fact of the matter is, if you study the history of this, let's start with the royalty. They never shared the same bedroom. Never mind the same bed. We're not talking about in the beginning phases when they're in the 90 days of marital heat. That's an understood fact. The 90-day period is over after 90, 91 days, according to every study that's ever been done. 90 days of insanity, by 91 days already, it's over. It goes on to a certain extent. But after 90 days, you have to live with this person. So first it starts out as twin beds in the same room, very close to each other with a little nightstand. Then it's not so much twin beds. You get the bigger beds in the same room. Then if you have a little money, it's two bedrooms. That's how it works. But that's the fact of the matter. There's no shame in it. You can still get together when you want. But you have two different lives, two different minds. Why do you have to share every second in the bedroom? Well, that's some sacred place to be there? The way people are today individually, they don't want to be in the same room. And by the way, this is not limited to America. I spent many years, I'll give you an example, an anthropological experience about men and women. In Fiji, let's go back to the years I was going to Fiji in the village. And this is a delicate subject. The men had a men's house and the women had a women's house. And when the women went through their monthly cycle, the women went into the women's house with the other women. The men didn't want to be around them. Now, what does that make the men in Fiji? Does it make them sexist? Does it make them whatever ist you want to call it? They know from their culture that they didn't want to be around the woman at that time for whatever the reasons were. And I got news for you. The woman would rather be with her friends at that time than the guy. So he went over to his the friend's house. They all hung out and slept in the same big straw hut. And the women slept together. That's how they did it in Fiji. I'm giving you one example. So this whole idea of how to raise a child or how to live with a woman or a woman how to live with a man, there's no set rule. There's no set rules in this area. And a lot of what we see going on today is a devolution, not an evolution. The people don't even actually understand how to live with each other or how to raise children. And what they always do is try the liberal methodology in every case on the natch, and they think that by going on the natch with liberalism, it's going to work, and it often doesn't. What you have to do is go back to the traditional methods of raising children and the traditional methods of living in the same household, man and woman, woman and man. Now we'll take your calls on the Savage Nation. San Francisco, Fareed, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yes, hello. Thanks, Michael. I just wanted to say that, firstly, I listen to your show regularly, and I'm a moderate Muslim in America, and I think that you're one of the most, let's say, honest first people in the media today. The one thing I wanted to comment on is that with respect to moderate Muslims, they feel under tremendous pressure in the U.S. and in general in Europe as well. And that is because, obviously, of what the radical guys are doing. And what I just wanted to say to you is that, you know, you do talk about radical Islam on your show frequently, is to kind of distinguish that from the kind of mainstream normal Muslims living in America who are kind of normal people.
Listen, you don't have to sell me on that, because I know a few people who are of Islamic tradition. Practicing the Muslim religion, if you want to put it to you, that the Islamic religion. But you know, there's a differential. I bet you're a little older, Fareed.
Yes.
I'm sorry, what are you, in your 50s?
Yeah, I'm in my 50s.
That's what I'm saying. You see, you come from another generation that was not radicalized. But there's a whole generation of converts to Islam who have been converted by Wahhabi preachers who are preaching revolution. You cannot preach the overthrow of a government. You cannot preach bomb, 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 and kill, kill, kill. And yet you know and I know what's going on. And you, by the way, you, as a man in the middle, which is what you really are here, are under greater pressure than we non-Muslims are, to put it in those terms.
Yes, I would agree with you on that, Michael. And, you know, what I would simply say to you is that there are a lot of people in the Muslim community who are absolutely fed up with what the throwbacks are doing. You know,
oh, God bless you. Absolutely. Look, Fareed, I've tried to say that over and over again. You know, for many, many years, there were Muslims in America who never, not only didn't try to overthrow the government, not only didn't try to drag the country into the ninth century, but were just like everybody else, but they just had a different religion. They went about their business, much as Jews do, much as Hindus do, Buddhists do. No one, you know, heard from them. You know what I'm saying? They practice their religion. Now, all of a sudden, we have this virulent America hatred coming into the mosques. And you know where it's coming from. I'm sure you see it around you, and you don't know what to do about it.
You see, the issue, Michael, what has happened is, unfortunately, that in a lot of the preacher community, particularly in some of the Muslim countries as well, a lot of the very uneducated people went into and became preachers. And
yes. Absolutely. These are the adults who can hardly read themselves. They read one book, the Quran, and they think that they're geniuses. And they believe in the self-sufficiency of the book, the Quran. They're living in the 7th or 8th century. They're throwbacks. Not only are they a threat to the Western world, they're a threat primarily to guys like you. You're under a greater threat than I am, because you're in the direct line of fire.
Absolutely. And what I would say is that there is...
Hold on. Fareed, this is very important for my audience to hear. It's all tied to the demand for cheap labor. That's what it is. Make no mistake about it. The people running the factories want cheap labor. Unfortunately, they're creating economic strife as well as economic advantage. And the economic strife and the social strife and religious strife are very serious side effects of the primary disease called illegal immigration.
to continue, Michael, I was just saying that also with respect to, for example, the Middle East issue, the view of a lot of moderate Muslims, particularly in America as well as Europe, is that, you know, there should be peace with Israel at the sooner rather than later. And I can tell you that there are a lot of people, even in the Middle East, in countries which are, let's say, the moderate countries, who are pursuing an initiative. Even as we speak, we have the Foreign Minister of Israel in Washington this week. We also have the National
Security. Well, let me say this. You know, let me say this on that issue. There are many other issues other than the Middle East that agitate, that are agitating the world. For example, Muslims at war with their Hindu neighbors over Kashmir, Muslims at war with their Philippine neighbors over the Philippine Islands, the Muslim problem with Russia, nothing to do with Israel. But, you know, value-wise, Fareed, I will bet that you raised your family very similar, in a very similar manner to how I raised. I bet your family values are similar to mine.
Absolutely, absolutely. They're exactly similar. And I tell you, Michael, that I personally feel at the end of the day that it should be a value-driven society. It should be driven by the highest common denominator. In other words, you know, principles of love, tolerance, goodness are universal.
Yes, but you're a classically educated man. It doesn't really matter what your religion is. You understand tolerance. You hit the nail on the head earlier when you said many of these imams are throwback who latched onto a Quran and suddenly made themselves into holy men. They're the people trying to pull the world back into the 7th or 8th century, where they are something important. They oppress women. They oppress other races. They live for bloodthirstiness. They live for murder. And I don't know how to stop them other than to say it's only the middle-of-the-road Muslim who can do it. I know it's putting a big burden on you. The government here can do a lot more by banning this kind of preaching in mosques. They could stop it yesterday. I mean, if they get a priest getting up saying kill Muslims, they would stop him, and they should. They should stop the man. That's not freedom of religion. That should never be protected speech. But if it's going on in a mosque, it shouldn't be off bounds for them to close that mosque down and deport the imam.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
You know what? I'm going to open it up to anything. Give me some rock and roll. Let's do... do you have The Great Pretender by The Platters? I heard it the other night. I really loved it. I was in a very sad, depressed mood. I was alone. I go into these moods in and out. I admit it. I'm not ashamed of it. You know, it gets back to something... You got it. Look at that. The bouncing Prozac pill. Follow it along the bottom of the radio speaker. The bouncing Prozac pill.
I pretend too much. I'm lonely, but no one can tell. Oh, yes, I'm the great pretender.
Ooh.
Adrift in a world of my.
Great song, actually, to be honest with you. Anyway, turn it on. It's my own thing. But so I'm getting into one of those moods, and I decide to have a couple of drinks by myself, which I did. And I had a couple of drinks, and then, you know, the mood went away. But the thing I'm telling you is that life sucks. And once you accept that life sucks, it becomes easier to deal with. And that's why there's so much weakness in America, is because we're deluded into thinking that we're supposed to be happy, and everyone else is happy, and you're the only one who's feeling lonely, or you're feeling life's burdens and no one else, and you look at the ads every minute, there's a ha-ha and a ho-ho and a hee and it, and the media continuously drives this concept that everyone else is having a great time except you. You're the only one having a miserable time. But in fact, this is what life is. And a lot of it is the fact that you were raised, if you're a person under 45, you were probably raised in a Spockian, you know, nightmare where you were told that life is pleasant, life is easy, life is good. And maybe it is for you. You know, maybe you're a lucky person. You'd be the exception. You're not the norm. For most people, life is a grind, life is a bore, and life is difficult, and life sucks. And there is no happiness. Happiness is fleeting. Happiness is transient. Happiness exists here and there. You have moments of happiness, whatever they may be for you. I don't know what they are. The birth of a child, the wedding of your daughter. I don't know what the hell. Walking your child, seeing the kid in the graduation hat. Whatever it is, I don't know, getting a promotion, seeing a book published. There are small moments, but basically it's a flat line of difficulty for the average person. Then you get sick and you suffer, and then you die a horrible death, usually alone in a home or in a hospital. And once you accept that that's the terms, that's the deal, that's it. It isn't that bad when you realize what people have suffered through the ages. So what you have to do is toughen yourself up, and you have to learn that life is not the delusion that if only there was another elected official out there who gave you free medical care, if he gave you prescription drugs, you'd be happy if you had prescription drugs. If only you had more prescription drugs, more crutches from the government, then you'd be happy. And you got to pray a lot. I mean, you got to go back to the holy books that your fathers or grandfathers, you're only probably, no matter who you are, let's say your hair is green and you got 18 nose rings and nipple rings and this ring and that ring, and you're running around in L.A. twinkling around thinking you're free, you're free, you're free. I don't hear freedom. I hear slavery. The more I hear those rings rattle, the more I know you're a slave. You're probably only two generations at most away from a very religious person in your family. Max, two generations. The most. Someone who actually believed in the Word of God and went to church or synagogue. And you may find that, you know, is the way to go. You know, there are. What I found is that there's no single way to go in my own case. It doesn't work for you. It works for me. You got to do an awful lot of different things. Exercise, vitamins, eat right, know how to control yourself, know where to get your pleasure, know where not to get your pleasure. You got to pray. You got to believe in God. You know, everything is part of the whole. There's no single path for the modern man. There's no simple solution for it all. In other words, you just got to deal with life's burdens. Or else, what are you going to do? What, are you going to kill yourself? Well, okay. So, it is related to politics, what I'm saying to you. We're living in a delusional nation. Everything is fantasy. We all watch too much TV, too many movies. I myself do. I admit it. I don't know how much of what how many movies I've watched. If I could redo one thing in my life, I would never have watched movies or television in my life. I can't imagine life without it. I've been brainwashed since I'm a child. Remember, I'm born in the television age. Would you believe I go back to a time before there was television? Can you believe that? That's amazing. But I remember living in a time when there was no television in a house. There was only a radio. We would sit around and listen to the radio. I'd lie on my father's lap. He'd smoke Philip Morris, God rest his soul. And we'd listen to shows like The Green Hornet and whatever. And you had to use your imagination. When you listen to radio as a child, this is why I'm so talented in radio. Because I grew up on radio. Don't you understand there's a difference? It's not that there are people who are younger than me who can't do radio, but my father used to explain to me that radio was actually a better medium. He used to say to me, I like radio better. I said, why, Dad? Because you have to. He used to say to me, because you have to use your imagination. I said, oh, okay. So he taught me how to use my imagination. Not that it was too hard for me to do so. There was so much tragedy in my youth that I learned to live in a fantasy world. I created my own fantasy world in order to overcome the tragedy of my childhood. But that's good. That is good. That's what creative people do. They create with their sadness. They create with their misery. They don't succumb to a drug. Don't you understand that? That when you suppress sadness, when you suppress loneliness, when you keep suppressing these things with drugs, you're killing yourself. It's a small death. It's a petite mort. You know what I'm saying? Le petite mort. But it's not even the pleasure of the petite mort. Play the Green Hornet for the audience. They don't know what I'm talking about.
He hunts the biggest of all games. Public enemies who try to destroy our America.
Turn it off. This is horrible. Bad radio. What is this now? Many of you don't know how to raise children. You need me to tell you. You do. Many of you don't have a parent. You don't have a father. You don't have an uncle. You have no one to rely upon. And you don't know what to do. You don't know how to turn. And I'm telling you that this coddling stuff, I'm not saying hit your kid. Don't get me wrong. I'm not giving you that advice. But you got to teach your child reality. And you got to teach your child that life is not a bowl of cherries. You got to teach them that life needs to be hard, that life is hard. Life is going to leave you alone a lot. You got to teach your child to be alone a lot. Did you know that? You know you got to teach your child how to be alone a lot in order to be alone a lot, because he's going to be alone a lot when he grows up. Did you hear what I just said? We don't live in a commune. He's not going to live in Ding Dong School the rest of his life. Teach your child how to be alone. I remember when my first child was a baby. I didn't know how to raise an infant, so I turned to various cultures for advice. I mean, I was an anthropologist at the time, and I was immersing myself in Native American, everything I could read on tribal lore. I read South Pacific, this and that. But one of the things I read was how the Native Americans, some of the tribes, raised their young sons to be tough, basically. And when the young baby, if it was a boy baby, started to cry, they'd wrap the baby in a papoose and then put the papoose out on a tree outside the teepee until the baby screamed and cried till he didn't scream anymore. I read that. Now, of course, today the Child Protective Service is the ones that will not go to the home of a talk show host to imagine doing his own daughter and son and the son's friends, allegedly. The same CPS run by the hippopotamuses in Child Protective Services, the mean-faced, clipped-haired hippos who run these agencies, would, of course, arrest a Native American who did that today. But it was a pretty good idea. In other words, a child will cry and cry and cry till there's no crying left. And guess what? Then the child becomes hardened. He's harder as a result. Oh, he doesn't feel as much as you want him to feel? Oh, he doesn't feel like you want him to feel? You want him to be a feeling man? You want him to be a metrosexual son? Maybe you don't want him to be a metrosexual son. Maybe if you raised your son a little bit more like that, and then you watched a few shows on the Spetsnaz training for the Russian Special Forces, and see how tough these guys are compared to even our toughest of tough. In other words, what they do in the Special Forces in Russia to train their men, you couldn't do here in America. They consider what the Russian Special Forces do to each other makes waterboarding look like a picnic on Sunday. But don't tell that to Obama. What they do to each other in training, they punch each other in the nose. There are no teeth guards. There are no nose guards. They beat each other up. And if the guy can't handle it, they throw him out of the Russian Special Forces. Here, right away, Obama would break down the Marine training or the Special Forces training, saying it's a little too rough. Okay? Now you understand where we're at? When we have Marines who actually are trained to hunt and kill and go out and hunt and kill like they've been trained to do as kids, and that's why they're tough enough to go into the U.S. Marines, and they do the job they were trained to do, what happens? Some puke wearing a uniform who's really a lawyer, who's too stupid to get a job in civilian life, goes after the kid who does his job. That's where I'm concerned about my country.
Savage.
You know, I was walking around after lunch. I had another disgusting, horrible Chinese meal. I enjoyed it. Don't get me wrong. I enjoy it. I have a love-hate relationship with bad Chinese food. I can't control it. It's an addiction. I knew I shouldn't eat it. I knew I should have gone to a salad bar. But I, instead, like a robot, I walked over to the same greasy spoon Chinese that I've eaten in for 20 years and had the greasy curry because it's Tuesday. And it's delicious. I know it ruined my blood lipids. I know it blew out my arterial health. I got bloated. I got tired. I never felt better. It relaxed me. And then I came back and said, there's only one cure for this feeling, and that's coffee, a cookie, and a fruit salad. So I made the unfortunate decision to stop in Starbucks. Oh, and that's when the fun began. Another one of the druggies on rehab was working there. They rotate him out of rehab right into Starbucks. Some white girl with a scarf on her head. I don't know what the scarf was. It has nothing to do with Islam, so don't misinterpret it. She's just a screwed-up white girl. Or I didn't say any. I said, I'd like a small coffee. How hard is this? I'd like a small coffee, an oatmeal raisin cookie, and a fruit salad. All right. So far, so good. Out the fruit salad I pick out of the... And then she did. I will look carefully to make sure that they're not touching the cookie with a diseased finger. I see they use a tongue. So far, that's number two is good. Number three, the coffee they put on the counter. She says $6.15. I didn't say a word. I put it out. Then she says to me, is the tall coffee for you too? I said, what? I said, I asked for a small coffee. She said, I know, but here's a tall coffee. I said, but I asked for a small coffee. She gets hostile and says, welcome to Starbucks. In Starbucks, we call a small coffee a tall coffee. I said, hey, honey, I've been eating in Starbucks before you went into rehab. Don't lecture me and don't start a fight. That's all I had to say to Miss Rehab. Hell broke loose. I saw the crowd of sheeple already were on her side. Someone stood up to Miss Rehab. I said, hey, honey, you're not going to last too long in this joint. You can't even hold on to this job. You're picking a fight with a customer? She threw the bag. She threw the dime, and I walked out. That's sad. Welcome to San Francisco. So I'm walking back to the radio studio. I walk across a park, and something occurred to me. It's odd to live in a city without children. It's as though a blight has hit the city. It's as though a disease has hit the city. It's as though we're living in some bizarre end of times city where there are no children. You don't hear children laughing. You don't see people pushing carriages. It's a city filled with homosexuals and hedonists of the heterosexual variety, but there are virtually no children, except in isolated pockets of the city, primarily in the ethnic communities. But in the white districts, there are no children. It's a bizarre thing to walk around the city where there are no children. It's an unnatural thing to walk around a city where there are no children. It's a crazy thing to be in a city where there are no children. In fact, it's an insane thing to be in a city with no children. That's why I love the city. It's like bad Chinese food. Tucson, Arizona. Todd, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, I met a lady in the parking lot that was listening to
Hold it now.
Radio.
This is a family show, sir.
Oh, yeah. She was listening to your radio program, little French immigrant lady. And
yeah.
I was listening to the fact she was listening to your program, and I looked at her and said, are you listening to Dr. Savage? And the look on her face was like I caught her stealing or something. She looked up as she turned the radio down, and she apologized to me, and I started laughing. I said, oh, no, ma'am. I said, I love Dr. Savage. He's great. And she got into some stories about her French culture and coming from France, and I mean, the praises that she had for you and how accurate you were and, you know.
Now why did she turn the show off, do you think? Because, what, she was afraid you were a hater of the show?
More than likely. That's what I mean. She kind of had that embarrassed, like, you know, she got caught doing something she shouldn't have.
Well, she sounds like a nice lady, also very shy. And how did it end up? Okay, or someone pulled a gun out in the parking lot?
No, she was kind of woman you'd want to, you know, go have a drink with and chat.
Hold it now. As I said, it's a family show. We can't go there. Well, how old a woman was she, Todd?
Oh, she was probably in her, I'd say 70s.
But she was French, so therefore the rules still apply.
<Very good.
laughs> Hey, thanks for thinking of me. That's all. It's a light day. Play another Bobby Darin. You did it already beyond the sea. What else do we have for him? Of him.
Every night I hope and
this? That's not Bobby Darin. This is Bobby Darin? I don't like it. I'm not into it. Let me hear something that reminds me of a 57 Chevy, two four-barrel carburetors, fins. Give me, like, I don't know. Give me Danny and the Juniors at the Hop. There you go. That's it. Give me something, a real throwback song. I want throwback. I want muscle car music. I don't want to hear about senior sins. Makes you want to get out in a convertible, doesn't it, and race around? All right, turn it off. We're having too much good feelings here on the Savage Nation. I've got to get the angst going in order to keep the audience listening. I got to get them angry, I suppose. But I may not be doing much more of it. I am so beyond anger. I am so beyond rage at the political machine, wanting to change the Democrat or Republican parties, that I could care less. I become apathetic at this point. I may change. Don't call me and tell me not to be apathetic. It's the greatest crime. I may continue to talk about filet of soul and my dog for a while and the red brick buildings and how I can feel the semen in the brick. I mean, S-E-A-M-E-N, the semen in the brick. It was an area where the semen were waylaid over the years. They go into their bars, get you know, knockout drops, next thing they'd be put on a ship somewhere. And I could feel this in this area, the Barbary Coast. You walk down these streets, it's filled with, like, art galleries, antique stores, a lot of lawyers for some reason. Thankfully, most of them went out of business in the last year, and the buildings are vacant. But they were formerly, like, little hotels for seamen and, you know, prostitutes, dance halls, that kind of thing here in San Francisco from the Gold Rush era. The buildings date to, like, you know, Civil War, post-Civil War period. I've always liked, even when I went to St. Louis, I'd go to the Gas Lamp District. If I went to Seattle 20 years ago, I'd always go to Old Town. I always liked Old Town. Old Town, Old Town. Whatever city I'm in, I go to the Old Town. Why is that? Like, when I went to Quebec when I was a youngster, I used to love Quebec because of the feeling of the old city. The Chateau Frontenac, I used to love shooting down that, what do they call that, where you go in like a sled, a toboggan run they had at the hotel. Wow. You get a bottle of brandy, you drink half of it, and you get in the toboggan. Before you know it, you're sailing along and you're having fun. What do you want me to do? Politics, food, music, science, poetry, global warming, how to care for children, vitamins, the care and feeding of children. Anything you want me to talk about would be great. I think that the time for liberals and conservatives in this country to come together and defeat the Islamofascists before it's too late is really upon us. Unless the radical liberal comes to understand that his greatest enemy is not the conservative, but the Islamofascist who would stone him to death, cut his throat, this country is doomed because a house divided cannot stand. Now, I'm not the one to pull everyone together. It's impossible for me to do it. I wish I could. I wish I had the power. I wish I had the power to reach through those distorted lenses where the eye that alters, alters all. There's no way to fix people who are so blinded with hatred. I've met people like that in my lifetime, particularly when I was younger. I'd get into situations that I couldn't get out of, and it was really frightening to get in those places. And to then extricate yourself from them is not easy. And I've been around people who have no reason. And I don't like people who have no reason. To me, that's a form of human life that's a place I don't want to go to, okay?
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I wandered the streets of San Francisco feeling the cool air on my face, wondering when global warming would descend upon the city. I was glad it hadn't because I really still enjoy the winters here. I had watched the Queen Mary sail. It was unbelievable. This was a behemoth. I thought only of the Titanic. I mean, this is like the new Titanic, this ship. Unfortunately for me, I can no longer pine for ships because I've spent so many years doing so when I was a kid in New York and penniless. I used to drive on the West Side Highway and look at the great ships of the time lining up on the piers on the Hudson River and dream that when I was a young man, when I would be a young man, I'd get the money and I would take ship trips. And I did. I did a lot of them. I was always in love with the sea. And then I was married. Then I had children. Then I went with them and everybody, took everybody to the South Seas. I did a lot of adventurous things when I was young. And I got a lot of the ocean liner thing out of my system. But I got to tell you, ocean liners of that day and cruise ships of today are two different birds. They're much different. When I would go in the 60s, for example, on the P&O liner, the Oriana, I mean, I'm going to tell you, that was not a cruise line. It was used for transport. In those days, the P&O lines, actually, tickets were given for free as part of the compensation package to British civil servants. So, for example, if they were serving in Australia or New Zealand, I think they got a once annual free passage back to the home country of England on the P&O liner. So the ships were used for passage, not so much as a cruise line, and it was a very big difference. The British were also very big on class differential, as they still are, much to their detriment, I think. And so you had a true first class, a true tourist class, and a true, I guess, passage class, or whatever it was. And at that time, I was a young graduate student, or a young anthropologist, or a lecturer. And I'll never forget making friends with some royal of some kind, a lower-level royal. He was a British Air Force officer. They always liked me. I always liked them. And he invited me up to first class. It was as though I stepped into another world. We sat in the drawing room, and we drank, and we talked, and whatever. And it was great fun. He made a mockery of the class differential. I guess he liked the fact that I was kind of a bohemian to him and an anthropologist that was real. And bored out of his gourd up there in first class, listening to the chatter. But today it's a different world. So anyway, to make a long story short, I watched the Queen Mary leave. And by the way, I was looking at it with my very powerful marine binoculars. These are the best. There's some German glasses that I was using. And I could see the people on the deck, you know, and saying goodbye. I didn't really wish I was there drinking and looking forward to X number of days eating and drinking and drinking and eating and eating and drinking and drinking and eating and eating and drinking and drinking and eating. Because I can't do it. Now, if you, on the other hand, have never done it, you should do it. Because the ships are amazing. That's if you really, you know, go out of the cabin and go out on the deck at night. I mean, you're in for some quite an experience if you look at the sea. I remember, and I don't want to go into the long story. I remember the longest ship trip between ports that I ever took was the Royal Viking Sea. It departed Long Beach, and it took 10 days to reach the Marquesas Islands. No, I think the first port of call was Tahiti, excuse me. It was the longest. It was 10 straight days without land. And I remember that before we reached Tahiti, I stayed up all night drinking red wine by myself. And I wrote a poem. God, I wish I could find it. I don't know what I did with it. I have all of my stuff in a warehouse somewhere all of those days. I was a different person in those days. But, you know, you're never really a different person. It was just another phase of my life. But here's the point of it. And forgive me if I'm wandering a little bit. I'm just a little fed up with politics for the moment. I stayed up all night. I put on the best clothing I had. The family went to sleep. I got the best and most expensive bottle of red wine I could buy at the time on the ship. And I stayed up all night drinking by myself because as we were approaching land after 10 days at sea, I could smell the land as we approached it. I have a very keen sense of smell. I'm very lucky in some cases, unless I enter the U.S. House of Representatives during July. And I could smell the sweet water on the landmass as it started to appear from the distance. And I remember writing about the smell of sweet water after 10 days at sea. I wish I could find it. God, and now I'm getting nostalgic for that particular trip. I wish I could be back on it, but you can't turn the clock back, can you? My only hope is that there really is time travel. My only hope is that the distance to the stars is real. My only hope is that one day we will actually understand that there is eternity. And one day, from eternity, we can look back and step back into our lives at any point and maybe, just maybe, change things just slightly and change, therefore, the course of our lives. Play some music for a minute.
See the pyramids along the Nile. Watch the sunrise on a tropic isle. Just remember, darling, all the
it is a song from another time, when the chrome was thick and the women were straight. Joe Stafford singing, what a beautiful song, God in heaven. All right, turn it off, right? I don't want to get schmaltzeroo here. Early 50s, I remember my sister used to play the upright piano. We had a little apartment, one bedroom. How many of us slept in the one bedroom? Mom and Dad were in one bed. I was in the bed. Sister was in the bed. Brother was in the crib. Grandmother was in the small, teeny little so-called living room. And they had a piano and there was music in the house. It was civilization. I doubt very much that all immigrants are the same. I kind of doubt that all cultures are the same. I kind of doubt that all people will produce the America that we wish. That's kind of what I'm talking about. We know that. Nobody told us to speak anything but English in the house. Now, my grandmother didn't speak English. She didn't know it. But we were told never to speak a foreign language in that house. We were taught that you had to speak English. Now, compare that with the immigrants who come here and spit on our language, wave their flag at sporting events, and tell us that we owe them. Can you imagine this? What's the point of complaining?
Savage.
I don't like cutesy. I don't like people who talk to their children cutesy. It makes me squirm. You ever hear these parents talk to their children with, like, cute talk? That's why the child winds up psycho. You know, I got to tell you a little trick about child rearing. In my opinion, one man's opinion, and I haven't done so bad. Speak to them as you would an adult, and they will grow up more intelligent, and they will be more competent younger. You ever listen to the people with the children? I love the ones who take them to a restaurant and give them a lesson in front of you to show how smart they are, how smart the child is with the pencils and the coloring book. You're spending $29 for a plate of spaghetti that costs 4 cents, and there they are next to you. The guy with the ponytail, he's 63, with a 30-year-old girl he met somewhere at a club. And right away, a year later, they have the baby. And 4 years later, ready the coloring book and the crayons in the pasta palace. And they're all set up. They got the whole thing. They got the backpack. They got the diaper at your next table. And they got the coloring book and the crayons, which should be outlawed in restaurants. It's not ding-dong school. Not everything is a ding-dong school. There was a time, and I raised children. I wasn't allowed in certain restaurants with the children when they were young. I didn't like it. But I understood it. People didn't want to be disturbed by children. Now, if they get sued, if they say to the people, you know what, we'd rather you not change doo-doo at the table, right away they call ACLU or a lawyer like an ACLU, or like a smarter one than an ACLU lawyer, the brother who went into private practice with the same mentality. Marvin goes into the ACLU because he's stupid, and Barry goes into the private practice and sues, but they're the same mentality. Two heads of the same hydra. That's it, the coloring books in the restaurant. How do you spell Louisiana, Louise? Very good. And then the mother claps at the dance. You hear this? This is where you're sitting, you're having a romantic meal. $29.95 for the pasta al ripoffo, antipasto consisting of a piece of old rotten cheese from Brooklyn that they couldn't sell to the Italians in New York because they know better, so they ship it to San Francisco. That's $9.95 for one little piece of mozzarella cheese. And a tomato. They give it an Italian name. $9.95 with a tomato and one little piece of cheese that the Italians rejected on the wharf. Even the wharf rats rejected it, but they can sell it in San Francisco. And $29.95 for pasta al creato. I don't mind it, all right, but you're going in for the ambience. No one's there for the food. They're in for the ambience. But the coloring book is there right away. And the lessons you have to listen to. Do you ever hear these lessons at these tables? Does this go on in Louisiana or only in the major cities? That you have to listen to these impossible parents. I never talk cute to the children. Okay, I'm a product of my upbringing. Harsh, Spartan-like. Don't be cute. I don't like cute. No jokes. Just get back to work. No matter what I did, I try to entertain my... All right, get back to work. Stop the entertainment. He knew I was trying to, like, wiggle out of work by entertaining him. All right, that's very good. Now get back to it. Now radio. On the way into work, I swear to God, if I was, like, driving in his car... I don't know how old I was. He didn't want the radio on. If I try to put the radio on because it was horrible, sitting next to your father in a car on the way to work, it was going to be a horrible day in a disgusting market all day long, which I didn't want to do. I didn't want to go to begin with, but I didn't say anything. Okay, he needed me there. That was the way it was done. I didn't have any option anyway. It was like a little prison camp. But all right, so you sit in the right seat like a dummy, your hands folded on your lap, and nothing, not a word, mum. The whole ride. BQE, the Kosciuszko Bridge, the stink of the pork dying there, the Trun's meat market, where the eye goes out. You think that you ran over a skunk, but there are no skunks in Williamsburg. That packing plant in August was enough. You talk about a weapon of mass destruction. The Trun's meat packing plant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn in the 50s was a WMD. That's why rents were low in those days. The floors were cockeyed with linoleum that when a dog would urinate in the bedroom, it would run into the living room. Because the floors were old. But that's the way it was. No one complained. Today you got the same losers who can't live in Manhattan. They live there now. They discovered the charm of Williamsburg. Oh, I really love it over here. It's really great. You know, it's right near the overpass, and I like the factory area. Nobody ever wanted to live there. Even when it was in its heyday, nobody wanted to live there. But the point I'm making is a little different. So if you sit in the car, you're next to your father driving to work, and you know you can't say anything. There's nothing to say. He's grim. He's white. His hands are white knuckled on the wheel because he's gone in again another horrible day to make a living. Nothing was fun. Nobody worked in those days for fun. This was an evolution of the Dr. Spock generation. Find what's fun and pursue it. Pursue what's fun. To my father, nothing was fun. It was grim. Horrible. It was like Grimm's fairy tales. Came over, work, drop dead, and move on. It's in the ground. In the ground. That's it. Next case. Next generation. There was no fun. From another world, they didn't know what the word fun was. So he's driving to work. The hands are like white knuckles. And I'm sitting here. So my hand reaches, the left hand reaches for the radio dial, like to punch a button in. No, no radio. So what do you mean no radio? I don't want music. Why? Never mind why. This is not entertainment. It's work. So, all right. So work has to be torture. I get it. All right. That's why I'm in the radio business. I was made for this. What I'm getting at is he didn't like cute. If he saw people, and I'm the same way, unfortunately, I become him in essence. This is how it is. All the years I resisted becoming him, I came, a long time ago I became my father. I admit it. There must be something to it. Worked for him. It's worked for me so far. But he didn't like cute. People who talk cute to the children. You know, the guy was 100% right. Let's say I'm talking generally, 9 out of the 10 couples did not talk to their children in because it was like embarrassing. Anyone who did that, the child either wound up in San Francisco wearing a pink set of tights at 19 expressing himself, or the girl wound up married to her sorority sister. 9 out of 10, they never wound up okay. None of them became anything. That's true because of the liberal upbringing. Liberalism not only is a mental disorder, but it destroys children. You need to raise children the old-fashioned way. I don't say hurt them. I never got hit. He didn't hit me. Just verbal abuse. It worked better. Let's move on. Las Vegas, Nevada. Matt, you're on the Savage Nation topic, please.
How you doing? I wanted Good. To tell you about the best Italian restaurant. If you're coming out here,
it's going to be a plug, though. That's not good. I know where I go. I'm not going there, but I go to one that I like a lot. Which one do you go to? Go ahead.
I've been here for 11 years, and I go to the one off Spencer, Carluccio's Tivoli Gardens. It's Liberace's place.
I was taken to an Italian place in Las Vegas, way out in the desert. And this place was not very fancy. In fact, the strange part about it was it had a sign for a ball team somewhere in Cleveland, Ohio, on the top of the building. You get the picture?
Right. No, no right. That's not the one.
No, but you know what I'm talking about, right?
Absolutely.
So I said to myself, why would they have a sign for a Cleveland team in Las Vegas, Nevada, unless it was like a billboard for people who were from Cleveland? Now, since I'm not from Cleveland, but I know that there's good Italian food in Cleveland, I went to the restaurant. I got to tell you, this sauce was really old-style, heavy-duty, unleaded sauce. There was no one in there, let me put it to you this way, with an earring in their ear. Can I put it to you that way? There were no guys with earrings in there, Matt?
Well, exactly. You know, you got to kiss the ring when you walk in, pretty much, in this place.
So you know the joint. I know the food was very good. The pizza I didn't care for. It was very doughy. It was old-style 50s pizza. But I liked the food. It was the unleaded, red sauce.
I mean, the restaurants out here in Vegas are the best. So
they are absolutely they are very good, and that's because the people come there with a lot of money to blow, and they want good food, and they're willing to pay for it. So you've had some of the best chefs turn up out there, and some of the top restaurants, and the people demand it. And frankly, you're not going to be disappointed if you know where to go. I agree with you.
And ask the locals.
That's how I wound up in that restaurant. I asked a fellow I met with a size 22 neck who looked like he was in The Sopranos. I happened to run into him in the elevator in a building I was in. It was good. I haven't been there in years. I haven't gone there in years, but there's another place I go to near the where they took the two New York homicide detectives out in jumpsuits. I had to try it. I wanted to see where the two heavyweights were taken out with the gold chains. With actual handcuffs and march. They were given the perp march. And I went in there, and it turned out it wasn't bad at all. The food was quite good.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
My father was an immigrant. Yeah, he came here when he was 13 or 7. I don't even know. He was not born here. I was born here. And he was a citizen when I was born here. I'm not an anchor baby. Don't get me wrong. I'm not an anchor baby. But I have one foot in the old world and one foot in the new world. So I really speak from, let's say, a knowledgeable position about it. I understand what it's like to live in a poor household with many people. Trust me, we lived in a place. We didn't even have a bedroom in the Bronx. And I think about it. There was one bedroom, and there was a tiny living room with a fake fireplace. And I remember we hung fake stockings on the fake fireplace. I thought Santa would give me a gift. So, you know, part in the old world, part in the new world. My grandmother didn't speak a word of English in the house. She spoke the old languages from the old country. I couldn't believe, I'm thinking about it now. And she was so wonderful. Oh, did I love her. God, did I love that woman. She was so beautiful. Very stoic. Very, very Russian, this woman. She spoke to me in Russian, by the way. I don't think you know that. I never told you that. I am not a Russian language speaker, but it's strange. I can understand the language to a certain extent. And it's a very hard language for an American to learn, incidentally. It's not an easy language. The alphabet's very complicated for an English speaker. I can just imagine how hard English is to learn for a Spanish speaker, by the way. It's not an English is a tough language, incidentally. Very tough. But in my home, my parents spoke only English. So to make a long story short, here I am, man-child in the promised land. And when my turn came to assume my mantle in this country and my chosen profession, they said, white men need not apply. The positions are closed. So you can understand where I was coming from. So to make a long story short, I cut a Virgin demo in 1993, and I send it out to about 220 radio stations. I get a return from about 5 to 10 of them. And 5 of them say, that's really good stuff. Would you like to work on our station? I remember to this day, one of them was in Boston, of all places. I don't remember the station that said, we like what you did. But nevertheless, I was living in San Francisco, as I am now, and one of them came from a local station, and the guy says to me, good stuff, would you like to come on in and talk to us? And then they gave me a fill-in. Well, anyway, here's the Virgin demo, 1993, Savage's Virgin demo, play 01.
And now, direct from the towers above Manhattan, it's the Michael Savage Show. To the right of Rush and to the left of God, and now, Michael Savage.
I'm glad I can be with you 7 nights a week because these stories are just not going away. I mean, every day in every way we're getting assaulted. Look at these questions before us today. Look at the questions before us. You know, they say that I'm to the right of Rush and to the left of God. I really don't think that that's funny. I really don't think that's funny at all. Do immigrants carry diseases? Are lawyers really humans? Is white bread safe to eat? How come women with mustaches, with peace and love and turtle-saving bumper stickers are the most likely to cut you off on the highway? Is Bill Clinton's mother a lesbian? Oh, by the way, a quick note. Nazis, skinheads, KKK, don't call me. Crawl back into your bunkers. You've given true conservatives a bad name because you permit the sick leftists to paint all conservatives with the fascist brush, okay? Don't call me. Do Labor Secretary Reich's feet touch the ground when he's seated on talk shows? I don't know. But these are some of the questions that I think we have to answer here. Because
all right, let's pause. You see how daring this was? Do you see how good? Now you say, well, it's commonplace today. It was not commonplace in 1994, by the way. It was really daring. It broke open new ground. I changed the media landscape. And that's it. That's how I started. Then I did a show. I'll never forget it. I'm going to just tell you the story, and then we're going to move on. I'll never forget it. So the local station manager calls me and he says, would you like to fill in? I said, sure, I'll try it. Now, I had never done radio except on book tours. I had done 10 national book tours where you go around and do radio and television. They were very stressful. But along the way, I remember various program directors had said to me, you know, you're really good on the radio. You should consider a career in radio. I had no way. How could you get a job in radio? It was as real to me as becoming an astronaut. Of course I wanted to do it. I didn't know. How would you get into radio? It seemed as difficult as becoming an astronaut. I had no way to do it, so let me put it to you that way. But let me tell you something. Desperation breeds creativity, and creativity breeds you take a lot of chances. And anyway, this is it 15 years later. I think that fate had a hand in this and God. I think I really was set out to do this from the beginning. All right, so he says, fill in. All right, the first show I fill in for is on a liberal talk station in San Francisco. It's still there. It's a powerhouse, 50,000 water. And he gives me a show to fill in for that guy is on the overnight show, and he's a hater of the lowest order, hates white people, panders to the most, let's say a Reverend Wright type. As exactly a Reverend Wright. All night long, hate radio against whites, against America. He himself, of course, is living the high life, as is Reverend Wright in his new $10 million house. You understand how it works. Curse America and go and laugh all the way to the bank. You know, yeah. All they needed was the Kool-Aid, like a Jim Jones job. So that's the kind of show I didn't know, really. I never listened to the cretin. I'm never up in the middle of the night. So he said, all right, I go on the air. And I start to tell about illegal immigrants and this and that. I get hate callers like I have never encountered in my life. Because remember what my last incarnation was. I was the good doctor. I was the nutritionist and the herbalist who gave lectures around the world. And by the way, I had even given a lecture. You'll never believe this story. I don't think I've told it. Normally, I would give lectures about health and vitamins and nutrition in America. At one point, I was director of nutrition for a major international nutrition company. They sent me to Malaysia to talk about their products. My audience were all Muslim women. So I go into the audience. I could not believe it. They were all Muslim women. They were a great audience. These were moderate Muslim women who were interested in nutritional supplements. They received it very well. I spoke, and it was translated. So I had been all over the world doing lectures, and I was usually very well received. And frankly, I was like the beloved doctor. Kind of thing. Now I do talk radio and I walk into a propeller of hatred from the left. I never encountered such hatred from the people that were the regular listeners of this guy's show. That night at 5 in the morning when the shift ended, remember what it was, I think it was 1 to 5 in the morning, I don't remember. I drive home from that station. The whole way home, I'm like in a paranoid state. I'm looking in the rearview mirrors. I thought I was being followed. I get home the next day. I said to my family when I got home and they woke up, I said, I'm never going to do radio as long as I live. I said, I can't take the hatred of the callers. The liberals are the most hateful people I've ever encountered in the world. I said, no amount of money on earth would be worth doing this. I called the station. Actually, they called me the next day when I woke up and they said, wow, you did a great job, Savage. Would you like to fill in again? I said, no, I would never fill in again as long as I live. I don't want to ever do radio again. Ask them. I'm not making it up. I said, well, they said, why? I said, I'm not going to go into a show like that again with these haters. They said, well, how about filling in during the day? I said, I don't know. I don't think I could do radio again. It's too hateful. The people who call it are full of hate, the left-wingers. Well, they said, okay, I tell you what. You won't have to do a night shift again. You'll do a day shift. And then, I swear, then I did a little fill-in on the day, and I shook up the whole local media. Then eventually they created a local conservative station, and I went on that. They made me an offer I couldn't refuse. Remember, I had a fairly good living. I was making a good living as an author and as a consultant, and I didn't want anything to do with radio, but the temptation was too great. And I got to tell you something else. Radio, you ask anyone in the media who knows how to do it right, they'll all tell you the same thing. Nothing in the world of media can compare to the high you get off radio. There's nothing that can compare to the feelings you get when you do this right. There's no performance in the world that equals radio. I don't care what you do for a living. Look, I wrote books. I'm not a Dostoevsky. I didn't write fiction, but I wrote really fine nonfiction. My nonfiction were all Persian miniatures. They're excellent. In fact, my first book, Earth Medicine, Earth Foods, is still in print. I wrote books to last. They were not just fluff. I was a craftsman as a writer. However, writing is a very difficult profession because it takes a year to conceive of a book, 2 years to write a book, till it comes out is like another 9 months. By the time it's out, you're not connected to the product anymore, to the work. There's no immediate feedback. And here's an interesting side note. I had an editor at Houghton Mifflin in Boston when I wrote A Maximum Immunity, a book that went into 6 different languages. It was a great book, by the way. It's still around. I mean, maybe it's a little out of date in some ways, but in terms of describing the immune system, it's a very good book. The editor, who was a really high-class old Bostonian, took me to lunch in one of the great Boston restaurants, and she said to me, you know, you really are made for radio more so than you are for writing. I said, are you insulting me? She said, no, listen to what I'm saying. She said, you're a guy who's got so much energy, and you're so immediate, and you can deliver an idea immediately from the top of your head perfectly. She said, you need immediate feedback. She said, you can't get that from writing. She's absolutely right. So There's nothing like radio. It's like riding a horse bareback. I don't know how else to put it. It's like speeding across a plane on a horse without a saddle. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? Other forms of media are like riding a trotters at Yonkers. You've got a three-wheeled vehicle underneath you and a horse and a bridle. Or some may approach, let's say, riding in another manner. But there's nothing like riding a horse across the plains without a saddle while firing a bow and arrow. That's radio. I'll be right back.
Savage.
The shameless shopaholics really happy? An article from England. Stupid women who shop from day to night, believing that devoting every spare hour to shopping will make them happy. Idiots. Are the shameless shopaholics really happy? Yeah, that's the consumer culture. I was never into that. I try to buy something this week. I don't know what's wrong with me. I have trouble buying things. I wear the same clothing for years. I'm comfortable in it. I know it doesn't look as good. So I went out. I forced myself to buy 4 pair of pants the other day. And I came home, I looked at them, and I proceeded to hang them up and put them in the back of the closet. I'm saving them for an important day. I don't know what that day may be, but I'm saving them. Then I buy a new pair of sneakers. That took an hour. I almost died till he found the right size. This size, take that size, and the width, a D, an E, a double. I didn't have the old ones. Finally, I bought a pair. I said, oh, fine. Just give them to me, please. You're very nice. Put them in a bag. Then I got a yen to buy a pair of shoes. Like an idiot, I bought something that looked good. They look like a... like an elf shoe. I went back to like the 60s. There was like an elf shoe. Like, I knew better. Oh, that looks good. I'll wear them around the house. I was crippled from them. I put them on for 5 minutes. I couldn't walk. So I had to return them. I had to have them returned today. And it was a strange thing. Did I tell you what the dog did while the guy was trying to shoe on my foot? The first time I put my foot down on that little stand they have for the shoe, Teddy was with me. It was in Nordstrom's. He didn't do anything. Then the next time the guy said, try the other foot on it, I put the other foot down. Teddy jumped between the foot and the guy's hands. So I try to think, what in the world does a dog perceive? What was he perceiving? So I thought maybe, trying to project my Darwinian mind to the dog, he probably thought the guy was taking my foot by putting it into with an instrument. What does he know? He's a stranger with a thing in his hand, taking his master's foot into an object called a shoe, and then like sealing it up with a lace. So you figure that was no good. It was dangerous. Then there was a miserable woman there, a middle-aged hag with 2 dogs that gives dog owners a bad name in department stores. You know, it's a privilege to let you bring a dog in a department store, and I'm really glad they do, because guys like me are good owners. This piece of garbage, she was from New York living in Marin. I knew the type. I saw right away where she was. She was Gertz all the way. I don't care where she lived. She could live in the best community. This woman was Gertz. It was Gertz, Gertz, Gertz. She had Gertz on her soul. So she has 2 rat dogs with her. One like a Maltese yapper. My dog doesn't bark. They start barking at my dog. No, here's what starts. I'm getting my shoes on, and Teddy's minding his business. And she looks over from like 25 yards away. I don't know where. They have eagle eyes, these Gertz women, the shopaholics. And she looks over, and she says something like out loud, like she knows me. What kind of dog is that? So I'm like, what kind of dog is that? So I said, take a guess. She wants to play Brooklyn with me. I can answer in Brooklyn. What kind of dog is that? Like, she's familiar already. I said, why don't you take a guess? So she says, a poodle? So I say, nothing. The best answer to that type is, the middle verb. Nothing. All right, so she don't say anything, but I see she's seething already that no one answered, that I didn't answer her. Maybe she's trying to pick me up. What do I know? I'm not interested, lady. You know? A few minutes later, she walks by, and right away, the dogs start barking, her dogs. You know what she has the nerve to say out loud? Oh, honey, you don't like that dog, do you? Meaning her dog didn't like my dog. Now, I could have gotten mad, but I control myself, and I say, this is why I don't buy anything. It's why I don't go out of the house. It's why I become a recluse and do takeout. I can't take it. People are mean everywhere, wherever you go. I mean, the clerks are nice in these stores. They're very nice guys. I don't know how they put up with people. I can't imagine what they must have to do at night to get over what they have to put up with. Well, oh, I don't even want to think about it. To make up for what they have to go through with being nice to people in these stores. I don't know how they get people to do it anymore. Then I always get sad in that department store because they have a piano player. It breaks my heart to hear I see a grown man sitting at a piano in the middle of the day, and I have the kind of kaleidoscopic mind. I know that this kid, it was like, let's say he was a C-talent musician, but he's like 45, good-looking guy in a tuxedo, playing in a department store. So all I don't see that. I see sadness coming my way. Why? I see all the way back to the first grade, kindergarten, preschool. Oh, look at that. Billy's talented. Let's take lessons. And the mother and father kill themselves. They pay for the lessons. And they encourage him to go to the high school of performing farts and blah, blah, blah. And the kid becomes an artiste and he struggles his whole life. And he's living on next to nothing. And here he is, 45, playing a piano in a department store. I'm not putting the guy down. But I hear the music and I get depressed. I don't want to hear the music there. I don't want to hear a piano in a department store. Because I don't just see the guy. I see like a whole tragedy there. Well, what are you going to do? I guess they pay him something. I have no idea. So I'm not a shopaholic is what I'm saying. I see an English Springer Spaniel became the top dog at the dog show. Top dog is English Springer Spaniel. And the interesting part is that he has a preference for chicken and garlic treats. For all of you who have the myth that dogs don't like garlic, the winner of the AKC show likes garlic. I knew it. Where'd you come up with dogs don't like garlic? Diamond Jim jumped into handler Kelly Fitzgerald's arms after being picked for best in the show Tuesday night at the Westminster Kennel Club. You may as well enjoy the dog shows while you still can. You see, dogs are hated by the Islamo-fascists. They're considered dirty and ugly. The Somalis in Minneapolis won't even drive you in a car if you're blind and have a seeing eye dog. The dog is dirty, you see. Soon they will outlaw dogs in America. And, of course, the leaders of our country will say, well, we have to be tolerant. We have to be tolerant. We have to respect diversity. So for the sake of diversity, there'll be no more dogs. Dressed in a glittering copper top that perfectly matched a brown and white pet, Fitzgerald cuddled a 6-year-old certified therapy dog. I'm over the moon, she said. Diamond Jim beat out a dandy Dinmont Terrier, co-owned by Bill Cosby, as he did at the big AKC Yukonoba event in December. That's interesting. So Cosby's a dog lover. That's interesting. With a few dogs barking and baying backstage, Diamond Jim was chosen out of the overall 2,628 entries in the 165 breeds and varieties. That's great. That is great. I saw a show last night on National Geographic about who was the first wolf to become a dog. I mean, how did the first wolf become a dog, or where did the first wolf who became a dog appear? It was fascinating. And one of the places they visited to find out the answer was Israel, where a woman has a kennel where she raises what are called, I think they're called canons, a sort of Canaanite, because they were in the area since the time of the Canaanites, the dogs, these dogs, and they were used for hunting and guarding and whatnot. And they're still prized by the Bedouin herdsmen in the desert. So this woman had a girl dog in heat, and she wanted to breed it. So she drove it all the way out to the desert to meet some Bedouin folk who she knew. They exchanged pleasantries, and then the dog mated with the Bedouin's male because she wanted to have more of them, of the Canaan dog. It was very fascinating. I still don't understand why dogs get locked together. I don't mean to get, you know, lowbrow about it. I still don't get that part of it. I don't understand the evolutionary adaptation of getting locked together like that. Like, what is that all about? Is that the only species that gets locked together? You have to throw hot water on them? When my dog, Tippy, when I was a kid, got in heat, my mother hit him with a broomstick and chased him in the basement. It was like nightmarish to the women of that day, a dog should be in heat. They didn't like the idea of it even. It was like, ugh. It was like, ooh, are you kidding? A dog in heat? Ugh. Get it out of here. So, the next thing you know, the husband might get the eye.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Now listen
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
We're living in extraordinary times. The last thing we need is a sourpuss feminist left over from the 60s, bringing back the panoply of maniacs like Janet Reno, Madeleine Halfbright, who bombed Serbia for no reason whatsoever, and the other killers and murderers who are under the guise of putting themselves off as some great heroes. Reincarnated before God, they pay for their crimes. In this world, they get away with murder. But I've lived through some historic times in my life. You won't believe this. And here they are. Look what I have seen in my lifetime. I want to show you how long I've been around this planet so you're going to get a feeling of what I've seen in my lifetime. One, Superman defeated by every man in World War II. Two, the first atomic bomb used in warfare. The establishment of the State of Israel. The popularization of television. This is all in my lifetime. The popularization of air conditioning. The popularization of air travel. The popularization of the personal computer. The invention of the internet. The assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, and Martin Luther King Jr. I've seen the first man walk on the moon. I've seen the mainstreaming of homosexuality. I've seen the complete integration of blacks and whites. I've seen the development of mass welfare for unproductive citizens. I've seen the destruction of America's judicial system by corrupt lawyers. I've seen the meltdown of America's borders. I've seen the self-genocide of America's European-American majority through a mass abortion and mass tolerance of diverse sexualities. I've seen the acceptance of narcotics. I've seen the debasement of religion. I've seen the takeover of corporations by gamblers and con men. I've seen the elimination of grades in many schools. I've seen the introduction of racial quota systems. I've seen the impeachment of a president. What will I see in the future? Well, that's for you to decide, not me. We're now going to move on to beer, wine, guns, beer, boats, wine, guns, cameras, stuff I never talk about. So let's go to the callers, okay? Chicago, Thomas, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to talk about my boat. The first boat I had was a 1972 Chris-Craft with double Rolls-Royce engines, actually.
And, wow. Rolls-Royce engines? That wasn't factory, was it?
No, it was. It was actually a boat that I inherited from a wealthy side of my family. I really didn't even know what to do with the boat.
That is amazing. But do Rolls-Royce engines do well in a marine environment?
Yeah, honestly, Mike.
No, I would imagine so. They use them in the air. What am I asking? Of course, they must do well anywhere.
Rolls-Royce engines is the most amazing boat. But at the time, it was a little bit over my head. It's a 38-foot boat. The maintenance, all of that stuff was just crazy. But when you said you wanted to talk about guns, I mean, there's the SIG 9mm, single action, double action.
Okay. Oh, you've touched the raw nerve. I went and bought a SIG P-232 with a 380 cartridge. I can't use the gun. I don't like it. I don't like double action guns at all.
Yes.
Don't like them. I'm going to return the gun. No, I'm going to try and trade it back. I've never fired it. I just don't like the gun. I have, and I've had it for 25 years. My favorite handgun is really basic. It's the Colt Combat Commander 45. That is a weapon that is, I don't think there's anything you can beat it. WOR, Bob, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yeah, I have a Glock 19. I'm an NYU graduate. Went in there as a moderate, came out to the right of you. But
how did that, wait, you must have majored in engineering, certainly not in sociology.
Well, I took a class in sociology, and it was filled with communist professors, and they're really brainwashing, young, innocent minds. They focus.
Well, that's why there are so many suicides at NYU. I'm sorry to say, why are they throwing themselves off buildings there? How can the kids take it?
I don't know if it's that or the tuition, Mike, but I want to talk about the reason why. I hear you like a Colt 45, and those are excellent firearms, but when it comes to home defense, you need a good flashlight, and I like a Glock 19.
Well, let's talk about it. Many people listening to this show are experts in guns, and many of them are not, and some are thinking about getting a handgun. There's something to be said for a semi-automatic handgun and something to be said for a revolver. Why is a revolver something people consider having by their nightstand as opposed to a semi-automatic? You could answer that very simply. Why? Because a revolver is a point-and-shoot gun. You don't have to pull back on the gun. You just pick it up and fire it. a semi-automatic, you're going to have to pull back unless you leave it charged, which I would never do with a round in the chamber. I would never leave a semi-automatic with a round in the chamber spring-loaded like that. I just wouldn't do it. But on the other hand, you know, a revolver is much more reliable in that regard. They're not going to jam on you generally. 5 shots, 6 shots max, as opposed to 14 shots, so that's a disadvantage. They say that the shotgun is still your best friend in a bedroom. A nice old shotgun, pump shotgun, best friend in the dark. Any topic is fair game. Guns, cars, cameras. You want to talk about cameras? Cameras have changed to such an extent that I don't know there's much to talk about. Everything's automatic today. I'm using a Nikon D70 that I bought about 4 or 5 years. 4 years, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, whenever it came out. It's far more complicated than my little Sony, but the new gigabytes on the little tiny Sony are astounding. And on my website, michaelsavage.com, the pictures you're seeing so far are with the Nikon D70, but I have a whole panel of pictures coming up with my little Sony. I think it's a 9 gigabyte, small, it's the size of a credit card. I never saw a camera like this. But I still like the heft and feel of a big camera. Although if you want to take a picture of a bum in San Francisco, I would suggest you get a smaller camera. Because you can get away with them where you don't have to, like, aim it, you know. You can sort of, like, hold it. That's the better one to use if you're taking anonymous pictures. The credit card size camera is better. Tim, Sacramento, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Dr. Savage. Yeah, I was wondering, have you ever touched on power cats? Because I know that they're really hot in Australia. And
what is that? Oh, a catamaran?
Power cats, yeah.
You know, it's funny you should ask. When I lived years ago in the tropics, catamarans were very popular amongst the sailing folks. There was something about it that was not traditional that I couldn't relate to, the double hull. I know they sailed flat and people loved them. I just never related to them. To me, a boat has to have a single hull to be a boat.
Oh, yeah. I was wondering, what size is your Grand Banks?
It's a Europa 42.
Those are beautiful. Yeah, my dream is to have a custom-built yacht by Delta Marine or Delta Outdoor.
Oh, yeah, they're magnificent, gigantic, though. You're talking about a 150-foot boat, though.
Well, yeah, well, they'll do a custom order. You can get a nice 65-footer with an ice-strengthened steel hull.
Yeah, I don't know if I could take that much time on a boat anymore. I mean, I'm a day boater. Truthfully, Tim, I'm not an overnighter right now. There may be a time later on which I'll do overnights on a boat, but not right now. Thank you for the call.
Savage.
Two little stories about drinks, because everybody drinks every day, whether it's water or alcohol or something else, juice. I saw an article on where your bottled water comes from. You know how the yuppies are always sucking from a water bottle like infants? They always have to have like a bottle in their hand, always sucking on something. Every minute, another bottle. Wherever they go, they carry it. I even saw a judge in a courtroom the other day, had a big, long, black holder for some bottle of water, like some big moron. He had to have his water bottle. He had to have his water bottle. A judge. You hear this? The yuppie judge. Everyone has to have a bottle to carry around, like an infant. So they all think that tap water is no good for them. No, certainly not good enough for them, nor their pet. They have to drink bottled water. Only illegal immigrants drink tap water. I actually drink tap water. Once in a while, I drink the plastic water. I hate it. I can't stand the taste of plastic water. Now I found out why I can't stand the taste of plastic water. It's because a study discovered this, that the National Resources Defense Council, which as you well know is a group of crackpots, a group of anti-American crackpots, but the NRDC did a chemical test which doesn't lie. And the crackpots found, in testing more than 100 brands of bottled water, that 33% of them contain significant contamination. That's bottled water now. Levels of chemical or bacterial contaminants exceeding those allowed under a state or industry standard. You hear this? In at least one test. Now, let's say you like a water called Aquafina, the top-selling bottled water in the U.S. Where does Aquafina come from for you yuppie schmucks? It's taken from municipal tap water in Fresno and Detroit. Okay, that's where it comes from. I guess they charcoal filter it or something. How about you like Santa Lucia or something from Italy, which you pay $10 a bottle for. Parco Naturale delle Fonti di Santa Lucia, right? And you think that it's bottled by monks who are celibate, who wear rubber gloves. Well, yeah, maybe it is. What do you think it costs to transport that water to your little yuppie restaurant in Austin, Texas? What's the carbon footprint on that little bottle of water you're drinking, all you greenies? And what about the recycling? 16% of plastic water bottles, only 16% of plastic water bottles sold in the late great state of California are recycled. You hear? Now, what about that $7 to $10 bottle of water? You don't need it. Los Angeles water, San Francisco water, turns out to be better than bottled water in blind tests. You're not going to believe this, but a test was done, a blind taste test, from people who think that they know something. And they tested water from Paris and from here and from there, blah, 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 blah. And they found out that L.A. drinking water was flawless or nearly flawless, according to the left-wing, anti-American, business-hating Consumer Reports. So the whack job failures at Consumer Reports with big eyeglasses, who went to NYU and failed at everything except writing hate pieces on business, did a test, and they said that L.A. drinking water was flawless. Even they said the tap water was good. You hear this? So I'm reading the paper this morning, the electronic paper. Italy's new dining experience, high security. Rome. Diners are flocking to what can be called the most exclusive restaurant in Italy, one located inside a top security prison where the chefs and waiters are mafiosi, robbers and murderers. Serenaded by Bruno, a pianist doing life for murder, the clientele eat inside a deconsecrated chapel set behind the 60-foot-high... Why would they deconsecrate a chapel? Anyway, set behind the 60-foot-high walls of the daunting 500-year-old Fortezza Medicea at Volterra near Pisa. Under the watchful eye of armed prison guards, a 20-strong team of chefs, kitchen hands, and waiters nightly serve 120 diners who all have undergone strict security checks. Tables are booked weeks in advance. Prison director Maria Grazia Giampiccolo said the inmates have developed a flair for their cooking. He said, I feel haute cuisine in a place like this prepares the inmates for when they are eventually released. The guests enjoy their meals, and although the security seems at first very daunting and imposing, they get over it quite quickly and forget about the guards. The mafia may be in charge, but there is no horse's head on this menu. Instead, a smart, mainly middle-aged crowd tucks into a vegetarian signature menu cooked up by head chef Egidio, serving life for murder and competitively priced at $33. The restaurant opened 2 months ago and has proved so popular that Italy's prison department is thinking of trying it in other prisons. I got to laugh for a minute because this can only happen in Italy, where food is life. Now, if you went to a prison in America and you had the criminals in this country cooking, can you imagine what you wind up eating? Jell-O. You'd eat Jell-O and candy bars. That would be their idea of haute cuisine. It's not Italy. Securing a table is as tricky as getting past the sternest maitre d'. Diners are thoroughly vetted by the blah, blah, blah. But there's no danger of the meal being disrupted by the annoying chirrup of cell phones. You hear this? They have to be handed in. Oh, I'd love to eat in this joint. Along with handbags, and I would like to eat here. If only I could go to a restaurant where some idiot moron from hell didn't talk on a phone. Blah, 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 I'm so important. And yeah, I'm going to Zurich. Yeah, I just got back from Atlanta. Yeah, I spoke to... Yeah, blah, 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 blah. I feel like pouring coffee into their cell phone. Why do they let them even talk? It's one of the reasons I go to restaurants. I can't listen to people. I'm in a talk business. So when I'm through working, I don't want to listen to chatter. But most people have jobs where they can't talk. So what they do is they have a glass of wine already for $6. Blah, 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 blah. Shoot their mouth. I give them two glasses of wine. They don't shut up. Then you get hit with a bad perfume on top of it all that wafts over and you got a double migraine and there's no point in eating there. Give me this prison. It sounds like a good place to go. Handbags and the diners go through something. In the kitchen, Egidio, a burly 50-year-old from Taranto and suddenly reigns over his team of six chefs. He screams, the pasta is boiling over. More salt, less garlic. Keep stirring the pasta sauce, he shouts. 17 years into his sentence, he is thinking of going into the restaurant business when they finally let him out. Like any Italian, I take my food very, very seriously. I like to be sure the diners are satisfied. And they don't just enjoy the food, but enjoy it with the same passion that I prepare it. He's in for a murder sentence? He's a prisoner in Italy? Maybe we could elect him to office here. He could form an entire sentence? perhaps unsurprisingly, given his record, diners have been reluctant to criticize. He said, before this, I couldn't even fry an egg. But now here I am preparing five-course dinners, and I have not had any complaints. It could be because they know who he is. Yeah, it's delicious at DJ. Oh, I love it. Oh, yeah, it's great. Terrific. Yeah, tell him that his food's no good. Most of the dishes the restaurant serves are southern Italian staples from organized crime hotspots like Puglia, Sicily, and Naples. Sommelier Santolo Matroni from Naples landed behind bars after getting into, quote, a spot of bother when he was younger, which earned him a 24-year sentence for murder. He, too, is hoping to use his new skills when he gets out in about 7 years. He says, I'd like to think that when I get out of here, I can start a family, maybe get a job in a restaurant or hotel. Hey, you should come to America. You know, it's the kind of immigrant we need. The unique nature of the restaurant has imposed some restrictions. Guards watch over the inmates in the kitchens at all times, and the cutlery used as plastic as other plates, said Mr. Giampiccolo. Yeah. The main thing is trust, and we trust the inmates to behave. If we didn't, we would not allow this to happen. Yeah, well, I'll tell you the subtext in a minute. Diners profess themselves delighted. When I heard about it, I thought it sounded fun, so we booked a table. And I have to say the food has been very good, said off-duty police officer, blah, blah, blah. The fact that the dishes are prepared by murderers, armed robbers, mafiosi, or terrorists doesn't really bother me, though I might be worried if someone had been convicted of poisoning. And that's it. Italy's new dining experience, high security. For years, I would go past Alcatraz Island, and I would think to myself, my God, what a great restaurant this would make here, instead of a waste. Why don't they just let some restaurant guy open up Alcatraz, and you take a boat to it and eat there? In San Francisco, in fact, they could probably rent out the cells for the night with horses. You know, and then they could be running the movie They Shoot Horses, don't they?
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
So today I'm reading a boating magazine in the toilet. I get the boating magazines for the toilet. It's a good place to peruse such heavy reading material. I like to look at the water there, the boats, the mega yachts that I can't afford, you know. But one article caught my eye: the Russian petro billionaires and the kind of boats that they're building. And the world's largest private yacht to be named Eclipse is being built by a man who's in the home of Marx, Lenin, and Stalin, which is now the hottest mega-yacht market in the world, Russia, where people are still starving, where people are living like serfs. There is a class of billionaire crooks who stole the oil and commodities out of the ground. They're living like czars, and they're outflanking even the Arabs in terms of super yacht purchases. So the biggest one will be built by a guy in Russia. It'll be a 557-foot mega-yacht. 557 feet, 170 meters, to be built by Blohm & Voss, a subsidiary of Germany's ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems. And that will cast a shadow over the current Lord of the Seas, the 525-foot Dubai, owned by Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, ruler of Dubai. Dubai. Ha, ha, ha. Dubai, Dubai, Dubai. Wonder where they get all their money from in Dubai. So the Russians are now out spending the others. Russia's eighth richest man, Suleiman Kerimkov, had it all, including the 295-foot Lursen boat, ICE, when he crashed his Ferrari in Nice, and now he's in a burn ward. Now, how do they make all of this money? How do they make so much money that they can buy two and three yachts? Some of these guys own three of them. One of them gave away a yacht of about 200 feet to a friend. So who are these oligarchs, these modern czars of Russia? They're young, in their 30s or 40s. They're billionaires overnight. And as much of Russia is floundering in a post-communist collapse, a handful of high-powered crooks with good political connections succeeded in gaining control of the country's vast state-owned industries and natural resources. They literally bought them. And how did they buy them? They didn't have any money. Many of them were college professors. But they were well-connected with the government. Follow me here because it's very similar to America. They were connected to the politicians, the corrupt politicians. And they get control of the vast state-owned industries and natural resources. How? Well, this took the form of loans for shares, deals and auctions, which some regard as the greatest scandal of the Boris Yeltsin era. And when Vladimir Putin, the old KGB chief, took over from Yeltsin, Putin was expected to undo the oligarchs' wealth. But what he said to them was, if you stay out of politics, I will not touch you. And so one of these guys bought a company called Sibneft, a company sitting on 30% of Russia's oil. You hear this? One man could buy a company called Sibneft. This was remember, Russia was a socialist state. So the oil, the gas, the metals, the gold, the silver was all owned by the government. So now during privatization of the Yeltsin, these crooks come along, and through corrupt politicians and payoffs, they get to buy all of these commodities, these natural resources. So this guy buys for $200 million 30% of Russia's oil, not of his own money, but he borrows the money because of the value of the oil in the ground. So he borrows the money, he buys it, and then in 2005, Gazprom, Russia's state-owned gas company, buys out this 30% of the oil for $13 billion for Sibneft. So the guy borrows $200 million, and he makes $13 billion. You hear this? Then he buys $300 million worth for the $300 million boat, the Eclipse, he's having built. And he also owns the Chelsea England Football Club. He owns a Boeing 767 airplane, a townhouse in Belgravia, central London, a 440-acre estate in Sussex, and a villa in the south of France. He is also the governor of Chukotka and is reportedly trying to buy Silvio Berlusconi's former villa in Sardinia. I read in the article, none of the above information was made available by the secretive mogul. It says he doesn't comment on his personal property. Ranked by Forbes as the world's 16th richest man, worth $18.7 billion, this guy will add Eclipse to a private fleet that already includes three other mega yachts, 377-foot Polaris, 282-foot S. Castilla, and 160-foot Susurro. Once he had four mega yachts, but he gave away the fourth yacht, 370-foot Le Grand Bleu, complete with aquarium, cinema, and helicopter, to a business associate. Now, why am I telling you this story? Because in all nations, there arises a class of pirates. With unlimited greed, they have no nation. They're transnational pirates, in my humble opinion. What else would you like to talk about? Seattle, Washington. Ryan, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hey, Dr. Savage. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I wanted to talk about the dogs. That's more interesting than anything else that we're covering.
Yeah, it is. Dogs are interesting. Well, I'm a dog person.
Yeah, you said that the dogs are allowed anywhere other than where food is served. And I just wanted to let you know, up here in Washington, I'm not sure whether it's a state law or federal law, but you are not allowed to ask a customer whether their dog is for service or not. They can simply say, I need this dog with me. And they
In other words, if you ask them if they're a legitimate service dog, you may make one of the fake psychos nervous, and you could affect their condition, and they could sue you, right?
Exactly.
That's in Washington State, that's where they do animals, right? That's where they did the horses.
Hey, exactly. And I'm serving there one Friday night, and I...
Oh, wait, what if you're working in a restaurant and a man comes in with a horse in Seattle? Can you come to any conclusion with that? What if he says, this is my service animal?
Well, I don't think we're far off the way things are going.
Yeah, you have a great governor, a terrific governor in the state of Washington. Great, great mayor in the state of Seattle, in the city of Seattle. Terrific place. So what, you're a waiter up there? What happened?
Hey, the first weekend that happened, I'm wondering, what in the world is going on? A dog's in here. You know, I'm allergic to cats. Somebody could be allergic to dogs.
Oh, my God. A cat in a restaurant, I never go back. I'm allergic to cats. I hate them.
Next weekend, I swear.
I hate cats. My throat closes up.
Customers saw that dog in there. The next weekend, three dogs are in there at the same time. And I'm sitting here wondering if
now, what happens if a dog takes a dump under a table? Tell me, you have to clean it up?
Hey, we got to clean up the puke in the bathroom, right?
Oh, my God. Do they make waiters clean up the bathrooms?
Yep.
Oh, no. Ryan, I think that's a violation of your rights as an employee. I don't believe a waiter should have to clean up a vomit in a bathroom.
We'll put up with it till we move on to something better, right?
Yeah, let's get off this topic. This is getting crazy. But, no, I see where you're coming from. But in Seattle, if a man comes in with a horse, you don't know what they're doing together. He could say it's a service animal.
Well, and...
What if he says it's his partner?
You know, I don't know that the law doesn't cover that. We might not be
Yeah, well, the law, you know... Samuel Johnson, the great 18th century English essayist, said the law is an ass. He pretty much knew what the law was. You know who writes the law, don't you? You know who writes the law. That it brings up a very good point. No, this dog and restaurant thing is out of control. Only I should be able to bring my dog to a restaurant because he's self-controlled. He does not pee in a restaurant. He doesn't even bark. But I could see why it's a problem. You get that woman, like that Gertz woman up in that department store, you know that her dogs will bark. And if you say one word to her, she'll threaten to sue with that mouth of hers. She probably was a lawyer or was married to a lawyer her whole life. Thanks for the call.
Savage.
I almost feel like now moving away completely from the politics of the day and almost going into the bars I drank in. The people I ran into. How I feel a little hungover. I always do very good shows when I have a slight hangover. Not a very severe hangover, but a mild hangover is very, very good for radio, I find. And I've always found it to be very good for radio. I don't know what it is. Let's see, what did I do? So as the curtain of night descended upon the Savage Nation's host, yours truly, Michael Savage, I wandered up to the district known as North Beach in San Francisco, the more or less still Italian district of the city. Actually, I didn't go directly there. I walked up California. I have a certain walk I like, which I'm not going to tell you what it is because I don't want to be, let us say, accosted on the way. But I walked through Chinatown on the way to North Beach because I love Chinatown. The reason I love to walk down Grant Avenue at night is because it gives me hope to see the small merchants closing their stores at night, raising their gates, securing their wares. It reminds me of my father's little store down in New York on Ludlow Street, how they would close the gates at night and lock it up and look with a love at the merchandise that fed their family. Now, you don't see much of this anymore in America. Most of us are so removed from merchandise and being a shopkeeper. But in essence, the small businessman, the small businesswoman is the core of the capitalist system and always has been and probably always will be, despite the dominance of the great corporations. The small businessman is the key to the survival of a capitalist nation. Anyway, to make a long story short, I also like to see the Chinese people. I like hearing, as I walk down the avenue, the young men, the vigorous young men practicing martial arts in the upstairs studios, either through the drums. The drums are also part of the martial arts. I hear them practicing Taekwondo in some of the studios. I mean, I hear everything. I'm like Vincent the Blind Man, if you want to know the truth, because as I walk, although my eyes are open, so are my ears, and I have very sharp ears, and I listen to the sounds of the street. I don't have to know one word of Mandarin to understand what's going on. And I say to myself, you know, this gives me hope. And the reason it gives me hope is because I know that the Islamo-fascists will never conquer the Chinese, not in China nor in America. I said, are you kidding me? You're telling me these Tongs are going to let the Islamo-fascists dominate their neighborhood? Never in a million years. They disappear without you even knowing what happened. And there are so many other ethnic enclaves in this country that will never fall under the sway of the sword. That's all I can tell you. They have faced the conqueror in the past, and they have driven the conqueror out. Of course, there are, if you want to get into the history of China and its conquest, then it was conquered by the Muslims at a certain point. But I won't go into that because you don't know that half of China is Muslim and a good half of China was Muslim as a result of conquest. But in the United States of America, I can tell you right now, they don't even know this is going on. These people live in their own world, and it's kind of nice to step into a world that is separated from my world. So I walked through the Chinatown, as I said, smelling the garbage in the street, and walked across Broadway, where you step across Broadway, now you're suddenly stepping into the garlic world, the world of garlic and jazz, so to speak, and you're into the Italian district. And for some reason, I went to a place that I haven't been for years. I used to hang out there a lot. It's an Irish bar. And I looked for my friend because I hadn't seen him in years. I stopped hanging out up there a number of years ago. And I went into O'Reilly's Tavern, and there was Miles, an old friend of mine running an Irish tavern. And we talked. I said, how's your son? He's 10 years old. Now, I haven't seen him in 5 years or more. I remember when he was a little boy in the bar. And I said, you know, I still remember what do they call those, giant dogs? Help me out here. I forget. And you know those big dogs, whatever they're called, the Irish something or other. No, not an Irish setter. They're gigantic. They're hounds. They're giant. He had a dog, Fionn. They only lived to six. I love this dog. I watched him grow up in the bar. This dog was so big that he, like a foot, was bigger than my dog Teddy's entire body. And one of the most beautiful dogs in the world. But he died at six. I said, you know, Miles, I remember your first dog, Fionn. He says, oh, I had a second. And he died too. He says, now I have a third, just a wee puppy. He still got the Irish whatever. I'm sorry I don't remember the name of the dog. I'm feeling kind of silly right now. I can't. But, you know, it was nice going in there. But on the way in, two guys offered to buy me a drink, and I never accept a drink from a stranger. I'm just that kind of girl. So I didn't accept the drink from the strangers, but we got to talk. It turns out that they're sheriff's deputies from another county in California who just happened to hear my voice and say, I can't believe our luck, and we talked. Whatever topic is on your mind will be fair game. Harold on WOR, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael, I got a good story for you. Listen to this. My sister was here from Ohio this weekend, okay? And she reminded me of something. We were kids. We used to go upstate to, like, Wurtsboro, Spring Glen. It's 1962, like this. I'm about 4 or 5. She's about 7 or 8. And they would have the casino up in the bungalow colonies, remember? So they had.
Well, let me explain what that is. A casino was a sort of separate building where they had entertainment and acts and things like that, like a little, like a little theater.
This is true. So they had the casino. Now, we were little kids. You couldn't go into the casino. They wouldn't let us go into the casino. Who knew what went on in the casino? We had to go to bed at night.
Right. So you thought it was something really risque, but it was kind of innocent by today's standards.
Exactly. It was innocent by today's standards. So one weekend, I don't know how they did it, but they had this traveling troupe of midgets. Midgets came up, and they were on the bungalow colony, and it was in the casino, and they let the kids come in to see the act. So the midgets, they're tumbling, and they're jumping, and they're running up and down. There was this one midget who was very amorous with all the women, all the mothers in the casino. Now, it was a weekend because all the fathers were up there. So this one little midget, I don't know how he did it, he gets down real close to the floor, and he starts looking up under the women's dresses. The men catch on to this, and they don't like it. They run the midgets out onto Route 209. I remember it. The midgets got in the
truck. You mean they didn't today? They wouldn't run them out. They would be tolerant of the perverted midget.
It was the
today they would wonder if they could say anything to a perverse midget. They're afraid they get sued by somebody from NYU. They'd say that although the midget was on the floor, he was an oppressed minority. And he had an obligation to look up women's skirts because he was deprived of this as a youth.
The funniest thing, I was a little kid and I...
They ran the entire... This sounds like a Fellini scene, running midgets out onto a highway.
It was the funniest thing.
But Harold, here's the main question I got to ask. It's very delicate. Were the midgets Jewish?
Well, I don't... You know, you asked me this question once before. I don't know if the midgets were Jews or not. I don't know. It was... happen up in the Catskills.
It just shows you what happens when you mix midgets with regular people.
It was the best.
They really ran them off the property, the midgets?
They ran them off the property. They ran them out onto Route 209. I remember it because I still go up there.
Were the midgets able to grab their valises before they left? Seriously, now, I mean, do you know the full details?
I was there. I remember it. I mean,
they packed up their valises or they left their midget belongings in the room?
I believe they left their midget belongings there because...
Oh, God. This is a triple crime. In today's world, running midgets out onto a highway and making them leave their possessions, can you imagine what kind of lawsuit they would have had today?
The men got so angry, they ran them right out onto the road. It was hysterical.
Yes, those were the days that if anyone looked at their children wrong, the men would have beaten them up and thrown them out on a highway, naked probably.
Remember, they would have the chow chow truck would come up. He would have Chinese food. We would get Chinese food out on the road. These things are
gone. Oh, that must have been real healthful. Oh, yeah, Chinese food in a truck. That gives a new meaning to the word roach coach.
It doesn't happen. These things don't happen anymore.
No, but could you imagine eating Chinese food? I mean, you take your life in your hand in San Francisco in some cases. I mean, the restaurant, let's say, where you got to go in and have a pair of galoshes to go to the bathroom is a pretty good giveaway that you don't want to eat there. Okay, that's to start with. Where the water is like a quarter of an inch deep.
It was incredible.
But Chinese food in a truck, unheard of.
Chinese food in the truck, the Chow Chow truck. I remember it. I was talking about
Unbelievable. I never heard of that. That's a new one on me. Well, that's a good story. Midgets driven out onto 209. Thanks, Harold. Let me send you a gift. I will send you a, how about a free dinner coupon to the Mafioso prison in Italy? Would you like that? I don't have a pass to that jail. I sat up there on a hill looking at the bay and looking at, I fed some fish. I have a place on a, in a hidden place with a fish pond. It's funny, you know, the fish have babies. They haven't given up a desire to reproduce. It's funny. I guess they haven't read the New York Times. They don't realize how primitive they are. The boy fish and the girl fish still do it. And there's minnows. There's big fish and then there's minnows. I guess they haven't read the San Francisco Chronicle, realizing how gauche they are. Laying eggs. Ugh. Viviparous reproduction. Yuck. Yuck. Eggs. Ugh. Yeah, that's not cute. You know, the woman fish gets fat. Ooh, she loses her shape. She doesn't look like a drunk stew bum on Sunset Boulevard puking on herself, going to prison for driving drunk. Ooh, that's the princess of the United States of America, a drunk stew bum who pukes on herself.
Savage.